Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International Law and National Security Practice Group, was recorded on July 23, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group telephone conference call. On today's call, we're going to be discussing the National Security Administration and the National Security Agency, and the collection, analysis, and retention of telephone and communications metadata. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. And also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're pleased to have on our call today three experts. As in the past, their complete bios have been provided to you in the notice for today's call, and they're also available on the Federalist Society's website, so I'm going to be brief in my introductions. We're going to hear opening remarks from our first two speakers of about 5 minutes, sort of taking the affirmative here, and then we're going to allow a little bit longer time for Professor Randy Barnett's response. So first, Stephen Bradbury is a partner at the Deckert Law Firm here in Washington, D.C. He has an op-ed in today's Washington Post on the topic, and in the byline, it recognizes that as former head of the DOJ Office of Legal Counsel, he led the department's legal effort to obtain the initial approval from the FISA court for the metadata order. Our second speaker will be Stuart Baker, and he is a partner at the Steptoe & Johnson Law Firm here in Washington, D.C., resuming that position after having served as the first ever Assistant Secretary for Policy at the Department of Homeland Security. And as I mentioned, our final speaker will be Professor Randy Barnett of the Georgetown University School of Law. He is a longtime Federalist Society supporter and leader and one of the leading intellectual lights of libertarianism. After we hear opening remarks, we'll get a little bit of back and forth going between our panelists. And then, as always, we'll turn to the audience for questions, so be thinking of your questions along the way. And with that, your opening remarks, please, Steve Bradbury.
Dean, thank you very much. I thought I'd just kick things off, describe the two NSA programs that have been the subject of these recent disclosures by Edward Snowden, and discuss briefly the legal basis for each and the way I think of the legal analysis, and then turn it over to Stuart. There actually are two programs that have been the subject of disclosure, and it's important, I think, to keep them distinct in your mind when thinking about these issues. And I'll start with the one that's, let's say, less controversial. That is the collection of communications, and this includes not just metadata, but also content of communications, that's done under what might be considered a programmatic order of the FISA court, pursuant to Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. This is the FISA provision that was added by the FISA amendments of 2008. And this is collection that is targeted at non-U.S. persons who are believed to be located outside the United States. And under this collection, it's prohibited to target anybody of any nationality believed to be in the U.S., or any U.S. person, which means a citizen or a permanent resident of the U.S., anywhere in the world. And so this is really content collection that's targeted at foreign communications or the communications of terrorist suspects believed to be outside the U.S. And I think as this has been disclosed and discussed publicly on the Hill and elsewhere, I think there's a general understanding that this is exactly the kind of collection that Congress intended to authorize when it amended FISA in 2008 to accommodate the special surveillance program that President Bush had put in place. It's actually even broader authority than that program allowed for. The second program is the metadata program. This is limited to telephone metadata, not email or anything else. It's telephone metadata. And what do we mean by metadata? Well, that means the telephone company's own data on the communications, the telephone calls that it carries. It doesn't include the content of any calls. This collection doesn't allow the NSA to listen in on anybody's phone calls, to monitor calling or track calling. It is simply tables of numbers that show what phone numbers have called what other numbers and when did the phone call occur. This data is collected into a database, which is kept by the NSA for 5 years, and it's collected under the business records provision of the FISA statute. Section 215 of Patriot added this provision. It's called the Section 215 Business Records Order. And that's a provision that allows the government to collect business records from companies like these calling records, this metadata, where relevant to an authorized counterterrorism investigation. And here the argument is that the collection of the data is relevant to counterterrorism investigations because the use of the database enables the NSA to take a suspicious phone number that's already linked to terrorists and to test it against the database to see what other phone numbers that number has called and what numbers have called it. And by looking at those calling patterns, that enables the NSA analysts to identify new phone numbers we didn't know about before that are also being used by agents of that terrorist organization. It's important to understand that the database itself is kept locked away. It's segregated. It's not accessed except, as I just described, the court order limits the access to queries or individual phone numbers that are tested against it once there's a reasonable suspicion that that number is associated with terrorists. There's no data mining. There's no trolling through the database. So, in fact, I think the title of today's program is a little inaccurate because there is no data mining in that database. There's been a lot of discussion about how can that entire database possibly be relevant to counterterrorism investigations, and I think the relevance analysis is what I described. The use of the database is necessary to follow up on leads with suspicious numbers to identify new numbers, which is a critical part of any investigation. And also, this is similar to the same kind of authority that regulatory agencies or law enforcement agencies may use when they subpoena records for an investigation and they need to secure a database in order to preserve data and be able to do focused queries to find useful information in the database. So it's that same kind of standard. The NSA needs to collect it and hold it in the NSA's own computers so that it has the ability to combine the data from different systems from different phone companies in an efficient and useful way, and also to keep the data secure. This is not data that the phone companies in the ordinary course of business keep for 5 years. They keep it for billing purposes only for a period of months. I should emphasize that by metadata, it doesn't include content, and therefore there isn't a privacy interest that the customers of the phone companies have in the data because it doesn't disclose their private communications or anything about the content of their communications. This is business record data, transactional data kept by the phone companies for their own business purposes. Same kind of information that agencies obtain through subpoena power every day in investigations that are conducted. And so there's debate on the Hill right now about constraining the NSA's ability to use this same authority for counterterrorism investigations. And I think it would be perverse to narrow and limit the authority of one of the most important national defense agencies we have engaged in the mission of protecting the country when other agencies involved in regulatory enterprises that we can all debate about the wisdom of are allowed to use similar authority. So, of course, the difference with the NSA in the world of FISA is a federal district judge has to approve the order, and that's not usually the case with administrative subpoenas, which often typically do not involve court approval. I just want to make one final point before turning it over to Stuart Baker about all these activities, and that is if we as originalists go back and think about what the Founding Fathers envisioned under the Constitution, I think it's undeniable that when it comes to national security, the defense of the nation against foreign attack, what the founders envisioned, what the original vision was that the executive would be the one to operate in this sphere because of the need for secrecy and dispatch. And it's really only in the modern age, since, in fact, 1978 and the creation of FISA, which was really a kind of a grand compromise between the branches, that we now have a system where federal judges, Article III federal judges, are involved in approving these foreign surveillance activities. And Congress is very much involved through the special intelligence committees that were created after 1978 to do very extensive oversight of these operations. So whereas the original Constitution and I think the founders' vision would have allowed and in fact felt it was necessary for the executive to have the freedom to operate with these kinds of activities without any court involvement, and indeed that's the way it did occur before 1978, now the model is all three branches are very much involved. And I think that these debates over these issues are healthy, when consistent with national security. And of course, now that Snowden has leaked certain information, the Director of National Intelligence has declassified some of these facts, and we can talk about it. But I think we do need to put everything in the right historical context. So with that, Dean, I think I'll turn it over to Stuart Baker. Stuart?
Thanks, Steve. I'll try to be brief because I think Steve's done an excellent job of laying out the program and what many of its supporters think of as the reasons why it ought to continue. And indeed, I won't talk about Section 702 at all. That is performing more or less as expected, and it's only some very misleading journalism that left us with the impression that it was out of control. And as the reporters have released more of the documents they held, it's become pretty clear that the minimization and targeting guidelines make that a relatively well-constrained program. Instead, I want to start with an observation that we've been through, as conservatives, we've been through this problem before, and there's something about the second term of Democratic presidents that seems to make civil liberties particularly appealing to conservatives, since the ballot box obviously didn't work. There was an upsurge of certainty that government, including national security programs, must be part of a plot to take away American civil liberties in Bill Clinton's second term. And the reason I raise that is because it didn't end that well. And I cover this in my book, Skating on Stilts. At the end of the day, the FISA court and its chief judge were compelled to say, as they've been compelled to say again, we're not a rubber stamp. We really care about civil liberties. In fact, they cared so much about civil liberties that they enforced the wall extraordinarily aggressively, scared the hell out of the FBI, made them believe their most important job was not fighting terrorism, but observing the wall. And as a result of that, we lost the chance, our best chance, to find the terrorists who were plotting 9/11 while they were in the United States. We had the information for 2 weeks and couldn't find them because our best folks, our biggest task force, was told to stand down thanks to the FISA court's enforcement of civil liberties. And that spirit is certainly abroad in the land again in the second term of this president, and I think we ought to give very serious consideration to whether we want to encourage an attack on tools that protect national security just because we don't like the current occupant of the White House. Let me talk about just two things about this program. Is it a good idea, and is it legal? And I think actually once you get through, is it a good idea, is it legal, it takes a couple of sentences. This is a very carefully circumscribed program, although, again, you wouldn't have known it from the misleading presentation from the journalists. I suspect they have and have never released the order that imposes limitations on how this data, once it's been collected, is used. But we now have declassified descriptions of the program, and there have been 300 searches in the last year of all this data. They may have a lot of data, but their ability to search it is carefully circumscribed to the point where they've only done 300 searches of particular phone numbers to see who those phone numbers are connected to. They don't gather geolocation information. They don't gather names. They're just trying to see what the social graph of the person who has that phone looks like. And that has helped them find conspiracies, including that cross-country conspiracy to attack New York. And so it's been a pretty valuable tool, and as I said, very carefully limited audits of each search to make sure that there was indeed a reasonable and articulable suspicion that led to the search. For all those reasons, it's pretty clear that it's carefully circumscribed. I contrast that with the fact that, according to information they sent to Congressman Markey, the phone companies respond to about a million requests for this kind of data a year from law enforcement. And those law enforcement searches are just, I've decided this is relevant, give it to me. And there is no look at the kind of reasonable articulable suspicion either before that information is subpoenaed or afterwards. It can be searched as many times for as many purposes as the law enforcement likes. This has been going on, because it's billing data, since there were phone bills, which is close to 100 years. You know, if searches of that kind of data were the road to 1984, I think we would have been there by now. And so that leads me to the conclusion this is not a particularly dangerous program from the point of view of how it's actually administered. It's certainly not something that we should fight bitterly, given the value it has for national security. That leaves the last question: is it legal? It seems to me it's perfectly legal. Steve has explained why the data is relevant. That's the standard under the statute. It is relevant once the court order restricting the searches has been married to the collection of the database. You can't look at one without the other. Once you look at both of them, it's perfectly clear that the data that is searched is relevant, and you can't search the relevant data without collecting it first for the reasons that Steve gave. And as to whether it's constitutional, the court has been pretty clear that you don't have an expectation of privacy in the kind of billing data that you give to third parties. As Ben Franklin said about other data that you give to other parties, two can keep a secret if one of them is dead. Once you give a secret to somebody else, you can't be completely surprised when it doesn't stay a secret. And so that information is not as protected as information you keep on your own person or in your home. And then finally, even if it were subject to this kind of Fourth Amendment analysis, at the end of the day, the question is whether the search is reasonable, at which point you ask, really, is this a good idea? Is this a well-run, carefully circumscribed program? And for the reasons that I just described, I think it pretty clearly is. So you've heard now two justifications of this, and we're going to ask Randy to explain why the both of us are wrong and give him a little extra time to do it.
Thank you, Stuart, and thank you, Steve, for those wonderfully informative and very clearly stated explanations of the existing programs, and as well as the legal justification for them. I know I walk away from this discussion and the description of Steve by knowing that we have nothing to worry about. Nobody on this call has anything to worry about. You certainly don't have to worry about the fact that by tomorrow, the NSA, an arm of the U.S. military, is going to be in possession of the data that shows that every single person who was on this phone call was, in fact, on this phone call, where you were located when you were on this phone call, how long you were on this phone call for, and through the use of identification databases also in the possession of the NSA, they can know who the phone call was with, and what, in fact, that is the Federal Society, and what, in fact, was being discussed here. But there's nothing to worry about because it'll take a court order to find out what Steve Stewart and myself said on the phone call. And so your privacy has been completely protected by that. Now, there's more to the program than that, but I just at least want to start by putting in perspective the degree of data seizures that are going on under this program and presumably also under the PRISM program, which we didn't hear much about. We didn't hear anything about so far, which deals with email. So let me, before I talk, I have 4 points I want to make, or at least I want to make quickly, because I think there are at least 4 distinguishable issues that these revelations have raised. But before I do that, I just want to emphasize the fact that I myself was a criminal prosecutor after law school. I went to law school to be a criminal lawyer and be a criminal prosecutor in particular. I was an old-fashioned prosecutor. I just prosecuted murders, rapes, armed robberies, and those sorts of things. And as part of my duties, all Chicago police officers, before they can present a search warrant to a judge, have to present that search warrant first to a Cook County State's attorney for review. So part of my duties was to review search warrants before they went to a judge. And the other thing I was able to do, of course, as a prosecutor was issue subpoenas, including subpoenas for phone records of people who either were under investigation or more actually, typically, people who were already arrested for crimes upon whom there was already probable cause to believe they'd done it. But at any rate, yes, I did have that power when I was a prosecutor, and that power has long existed. But every time I did any of those things, there had to be a particular person who was going against whom this warrant was going to be searched, seized, you know, against whom the warrant was going to be executed. The subpoena is also, I had to state a reasonable belief about why it was a particular person or a particular set of documents was relevant to a particular identification, to a particular investigation. It was all very particularized. It wasn't metadata. I think under the theory that we've just heard, let me get back to that in just a moment. So there is a big difference between the kinds of use of warrants and subpoenas that existed for a very long time and what we're now witnessing. And in fact, technologies have changed, and constitutional law has to evolve with those technologies in order to keep the original meaning of the Constitution in place. Just as it has in the past, when wiretapping, when telephones were invented, and then wiretapping was invented, and other sorts of electronic eavesdropping were invented, all of this required new constitutional doctrine in order to keep in effect the original meaning of the Fourth Amendment. So, with this in mind, let me identify briefly the 4 issues at least 4 issues that I think this program gives rise to. The disclosure of this program gives rise to. First, of course, is the issue is whether this blanket seizure of all telephone data and presumably at least as reported under the PRISM program email metadata, but I obviously could, I'll stand to be corrected on that, whether this seizure, this blanket seizure of all of this data is actually authorized by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act or FISA. When, as Steve explained, under the business records provision of FISA, law enforcement are entitled to obtain an order obtaining business records upon showing that a reasonable basis that these records are relevant to an investigation. And as Steve already explained to you, the issue is whether the entire database of all of the phone companies consisting of every single phone call made by every American and every person who deals with those phone companies is deemed to be relevant to an investigation. And here is where I will draw the analogy. Although the Chicago Police Department had to come to me to get a search warrant, come to a judge to get a search warrant, and I passed upon the legal sufficiency of that warrant before they did so. And although I could issue subpoenas, this would be like saying that I could issue a subpoena for all the records of all the phone calls in Chicago. because I now have a computer that allows me to run a sophisticated metadata analysis of that. It's true that the FISA statute doesn't appear to allow that, but under the theory that business records can be obtained by a subpoena, I don't understand why law enforcement can't do this from now on. And in fact, we are seeing problems arising with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau under Dodd-Frank now obtaining all the databases of our banks that would allow them to know all our credit card transactions and other financial transactions, under Obamacare and various statutes authorizing the collection of digital medical records. That data is going to be available as well. So we are seeing the development of a widespread problem of seizures of metadata or data that can then be put to use or bad use, good use or bad use in the future. So the first is it actually authorized by FISA? There's some members of Congress who claim that it wasn't what they meant when they wrote the FISA business records provision. We'll find out about that. That's one problem. Second problem is the Fourth Amendment problem. It's true that we have a long Fourth Amendment doctrine, but let's initially talk about the Fourth Amendment itself. The Fourth Amendment was put there to prevent something that was actually very similar from taking place, and that is the use of general warrants, which would authorize British authorities to search anywhere they pleased in order to find find activity that they were charged with preventing and stopping. Instead of that, the Constitution requires a specificity in the issuance of such warrants, specificity of the kind that doesn't exist with respect to these databases, although we're told does exist with respect to the search of these databases. It doesn't apply to the seizure of these databases, and the Fourth Amendment protects not only against unreasonable searches, but also against unreasonable seizures. And it is true that the police do seize, sometimes they seize property before they search it, like they'll seize an automobile before they search it, but again, they need a particularized suspicion before they're permitted to hold on to your automobile and go obtain a search warrant and then return and search the vehicle. So the idea that there can be seizures before searches is not something we haven't seen before, but on the other hand, it is not true. It is not the case that a seizure can be reasonable if it's in fact the seizure of everything, and in this case, it would be the seizure of all the business records of all the telephone companies and with respect to the phone calls that we make. So we do have this problem of a blanket seizure and the close similarity that it shows with blanket or general warrants. That's on the Fourth Amendment. Let's turn a minute for the Fifth Amendment. We have heard that the judiciary is now involved in the approval of these programs, and I suppose that might be considered a good thing. I guess it might be. But on the other hand, the judiciary is being involved in what we might call a secret judiciary. The order that was just revealed illegally, that was issued by Judge Roger Vincent, who happens to be a personal hero of mine since he was the judge in Florida who originally found the individual mandate unconstitutional in the case that ended up in the Supreme Court. So I really like Roger Vincent, but the opinion that we now know existed was an opinion that was issued in secret. We have a secret court that the members of which are appointed by the Chief Justice of the United States. They decide all their matters ex parte, which means without the benefit of adversarial proceedings, without the benefit of two sides making arguments. The telephone companies, at least so far as we know, are not entitled to participate in the process by which their records are being ordered to be produced. And certainly we aren't allowed to participate in it. And if that weren't bad enough, if that weren't bad enough, the orders that have been issued to justify the constitutionality of these searches are also kept secret unless they and until they've been leaked, and then after leaked, declassified. And then as Steve said, we're now allowed to talk about it. There is a problem, and I think it's a Fifth Amendment due process clause problem as to whether a secret court that operates in ex parte fashion is actually is consistent with the due process of law. So whether this is a good thing or a bad thing that individuals who are judges and have Article III judges with lifetime tenure are now involved in this process, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing is something that I think we need to think about. The third problem I want to just briefly – well, that is the third problem. That's the Fifth Amendment due process clause problem. That brings me to the fourth and final problem that I want to talk about, and that is just the overall secrecy of all of this. We have a fundamental theory of government here in this country, and it's called the Republican form of government. And under the Republican form of government, it's the people who are the sovereign or the masters or the principals, and it is the agents in government, and that includes the legislature, that includes Congress, but it certainly includes the president, and it includes the military. All of them are agents operating on our behalf and subject to our control. But for a principal-agent agency relationship to work properly, the principal needs to know, at least in a general sense, what are the agents up to. And the fact that all of these programs have been kept secret until every feature of the program has not been secret. But overall, I would say the nature and scope of these programs has been secret to the public. Special committees of Congress may know about them, but they've been secret to the public until they were illegally leaked. And now some information is being declassified, and now we can talk about it. This really does go to the core and undercuts the heart of Republican governance. I'm not saying that, in fact, the public should be privy to individual investigations, either terrorist investigations or criminal investigations. When I was a prosecutor, I could obtain documents. Everybody didn't know I was issuing subpoenas, and the police were able to obtain search warrants, and those were using ex-parte procedures. Absolutely. However, the existence of these programs and the scope of these programs, as opposed to the individual use of these programs, is also a secret, and it's very difficult to see how the people who are the ultimate sovereign can keep control of their agents if they don't know that these programs are going on. And that raises a very fundamental problem. And as to what to be done about all of this, there are going to be lawsuits brought. In fact, there is already a petition for a writ of mandamus in front of the Supreme Court, challenging the legality, under the statute, of this seizure program, of the telephone record seizure program. That petition has already been filed. There will be other lawsuits. However, you know, as I always said during the Obamacare litigation, put not ye faith in judges. Judges have throughout our history let us down. The first sentence of my book, Restoring the Lost Constitution, says that if judges had been doing their job, this book would not need to be written. So, put not ye faith in judges. In fact, this is something Congress ought to attend to, and in fact, Congress is attending to. Now that this information is out there, now that this information is public, we now see a host of legislative initiatives being generated in the House by both Democrats and Republicans to try to address some of these issues forthrightly and head on, and then I think we're going to see some progress made. And so, having identified my concerns, I appreciate the patience of both Stuart and Steve to sit through this talk of mine, and I definitely enjoyed their presentation and look forward to both their response and also the questions from the audience.
Very good. Thank all three of you. This is Dean Reuter again. And before we turn to the audience for questions, I do want to encourage some back and forth discussion here. I don't want to go through the order of the speakers yet again, but let me ask first Steve and Stuart if they want to give just a very brief response to some of the points that that Professor Barnett made.
Okay. Start off, Dean, if that's okay. This is Steve Bradbury with just some quick thoughts in response. And again, Randy, thank you for laying out your thinking. And again, I also want to thank you for your intellectual leadership on the Obamacare issues. Definitely respect the work that you do. I do disagree, though, with the analysis here, and let me just point out a small number of points and then turn it over to Stuart. First, just a technical thing. You mentioned the PRISM collection. That is the first program that I was referring to, the Section 702 Foreign Targeting Program. That's where the PRISM collection comes in. That does include content of communications. Of foreign communications. The telephone metadata is the one that has gotten most of the focus and debate and that we've spent most of the time on. So on that, in terms of the Fourth Amendment, I really don't think that the obtaining by a business records order the production or acquisition of this metadata is a seizure for Fourth Amendment purposes. I don't think it's seizing papers or effects in which there's a privacy interest. These are business records. I also don't think it's a seizure in a practical sense. There's no SWAT team descending on the phone companies with thumb drives to extract data by force. It is a court order like a subpoena, like a production order in a civil litigation for records. We can debate the breadth of it and the need for all of the data, but if acquiring business data like this for an investigation is a Fourth Amendment seizure that would require a warrant, then that would bring the entire administrative state of the government to a halt. Now, that may be a desirable outcome, but I don't think it's a constitutionally mandated outcome. I don't think there is some ancient common law mother tree that protects us from government overreach. I think we need to police the bounds of the Constitution and the Commerce Clause, but within those bounds, we need to argue on policy, I think, not on constitutional protections that aren't, I think, well-founded. In terms of the Fifth Amendment, the phone companies here are entitled to challenge these orders. There are provisions, express provisions in the FISA statute that enables any party that receives one of these orders whose records are being required to be turned over to challenge it before the FISA court. They can ask for en banc review before the FISA court, and they could even take it up to a court of review, the FISA court of review, and then potentially petition the Supreme Court. So there are provisions for challenging it. I really don't see a Fifth Amendment due process issue here. And then the final thing I'd say in terms of Republican form of government is I think we would all agree that it's not feasible or desirable to have a national plebiscite over these sorts of national security programs. We have to rely on our elected representatives in this Republican form of government, the president, and the members of Congress, who are accountable for decisions they make. But we do need to put trust in them to do oversight, to make decisions. Of course, if things went wrong and the nation were attacked, they'd all be voted out of office in all likelihood. So I do think that they are responsive and accountable. And when possible, I think we should welcome this sort of public debate. I think this has a lot of benefits. So, Stuart, I'll turn it over to you now.
Sure. No, that was very helpful. And I think it kind of crystallized for me that what Randy is pleading for is not an application of current law, but some new law that he prefers. When you cite late after the fact statements by congressmen for congressional intent instead of the decisions of a dozen sitting judges about what is permissible under Section 215, you're asking for new law, not current law. And when you fail to address Smith against Maryland, which says there isn't a privacy interest in this data, when you fail to acknowledge that there are special needs cases, numerous ones, such as border searches, school searches, which say you don't always need specificity in a warrant. What you need is reasonableness. When you try to say that it's a seizure when somebody gets information, when in fact you haven't taken anything away from the party who has it, you're also, I think, seeking to make new law. And all of that, you know, maybe new law is called for in some cases, but you have to be persuaded that this is a really bad thing. And obviously, I'm not persuaded. And I think for the audience, you know, if you listen to Randy, what he's saying is, what I really hate about this is it's secret. That's really just terrible. Well, you know, this is, we run the least secret intelligence gathering system, and not just because of leakers, although that's part of it, but because we have written laws that are far more detailed than anyone in history has written and published about how to gather intelligence. No other country thinks that this is a smart way to gather intelligence, and there's a lot of evidence that suggests that it isn't, and indeed that some of the efforts to make sure that everybody at NSA understood all of the limitations, produce materials that are exactly what Snowden is releasing as part of his campaign against the agency. The idea that we can do intelligence gathering in public strikes me as verging on Obama derangement. No one would have believed that under any other president, except perhaps in the last term of Bill Clinton's presidency. And I don't think it's time for us to go anywhere near a notion like that as a policy preference, and certainly not as a construction of the Fifth Amendment. Randy, it's yours.
Yeah, well, thank you, Stuart. I have to say that in the 10 minutes I had, I really couldn't get into all the case law in trying to outline in general sense what I think the problems are here. And so I hope that the audience understands that. In terms of current law versus new law, we have constitutional law in order to keep up with changing technology. It's always evolved in the past for that purpose. It's going to continue to evolve in the future. There's nothing particularly radical about suggesting new law. But even under existing law, the Supreme Court just last year said that it was a search for the police to attach a GPS device to your car and track your movements in this country. It was a search. The justices disagreed with each other exactly about why that was a search, but they held that it was a search, unanimously held that it was a search, by the way. And as one of the hypotheticals stated in the case itself by Justice Alito, suppose in the future that all cars have GPSs built in, and then is it going to be okay using the business records exception or the business records doctrine or the third party doctrine to say that it's a search to track individuals, but it's not a search to collect the GPS metadata on the movement of all of us? So as soon as it becomes all of us, it's okay, even though individuals, that's covered by the Constitution. So we do have a recent case, which is a very interesting one. It is law. There is a majority. In fact, it was a unanimous decision, according to different theories. And with respect to some of the older cases, like Smith versus Maryland and Penn registers, I did allude to that briefly, and whether there's a reasonable expectation of privacy. When it was the phone company, and this is, by the way, these are points that were actually also made by Justice Sotomayor in her concurring opinion in the Jones case, in which she questioned the continued vitality of the third-party doctrine in light of existing technology. But, you know, when it was pen registers that had to be individually secured against individual persons to record or trap and trace devices to record exactly who you called and when you called them, but individuals, that was one thing. Now we have pen registers for everyone. We have trap and trace for everyone that's going to be analyzed or could actually be analyzed. In fact, the whole merit of the program depends on the capability of analyzing this data using supercomputers in order to figure out what patterns exist and what this suggests about our own individual conduct. And so, absolutely, with a change in technology, a law that was in the 1970s, a doctrine that was in the 1970s suitable to handle individual pen registers may have to be adjusted a bit, as Justice Sotomayor said, to handle metadata collections by phone companies and our Internet. So, yes, I think some of the existing doctrine argues against these programs. Obviously, these programs were crafted to be brought within existing doctrine, but this existing doctrine has to be looked at in light of change in technology.
Very good. We've got quite a few people on the phone, so I do want to turn to the audience now. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question for any of our three experts, you'll push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for any of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've gone a little long in our opening remarks here. We've got about 15 minutes left in our scheduled time, maybe a little more than that, and quite a few questions, it looks like. So I'm going to ask the audience to be as concise as possible in framing your questions. With that, let's go to our first caller.
Hi, my name is Devin Watkins. Some of the case law, like Smith v. Maryland and stuff, held that the individual didn't have the right over the information because they gave it to the phone company. But what about the phone company whose data has now been seized by the government with no probable cause over the seizure, at least, of that database? And I hope you don't think by seizing, by copying, not being seizing, you seemed to imply earlier that, for instance, the government could just tell everyone that they have to turn over a copy of their hard drive for everyone's hard drive in the country, wouldn't be a seizure under the Fourth Amendment. And I'll ask that to Stuart Baker, and why don't we just do Stuart Baker?
Sure. I look, it would be a search for sure, but to say there's something special about it as a seizure when, in fact, from the phone company's point of view, what they need this data for is to do billing, they still have the data. They can do the billing. They've suffered no loss of information. They simply copied it.
Let's just talk about seizure for a moment. So if the government orders me to turn over a copy of my hard drive, but they don't look at it, they just want to keep it on file for later, that's not a seizure in your opinion?
Is it a seizure of data when they tell you you have to submit information on your income every year? This is a doctrine whose consequences we can't foresee. If you have to make up a new constitutional doctrine to reach this, you better be sure that this is a bad thing you want to reach. And I don't see that we've made the case that this is a bad idea. In fact, as a regular matter, Congress passes laws that say certain kinds of data has to be reported to the government about customers. For purposes of tax collection, customs enforcement, border security, and a host of other reasons, all of that information is turned over to the government. We do not analyze that as though it were a seizure. We expect the government to be subject to some regulation, and by and large it is, but the regulation is targeted to and tailored to the kinds of abuses that you worry about and the need the government has for the data. And that's exactly what has happened here, right? There isn't any doubt that this is regulated by the courts and by law and pretty strictly regulated. And so if you look at the question, is this overall an intrusion on our rights that we should strain the Constitution to prohibit, I just don't see it.
Randy or Steve, you have anything on this point?
I think we should move on to more questions because we don't have much time.
Let's do that.
I'm Mike Doherty here in Atlanta. I'll be very brief. I'm hearing my overall concern is a balance of power and actually operations management of this. On the one hand, this isn't a big deal, but it's a huge deal, the public. And who really is supposed to control this thing moving at us so quickly? Is it really the judiciary? Is it the executive branch? Is it the judicial? There's so much finger-pointing on less severe things between these branches. The concerns heighten when you have an operations problem like a Snowden, regardless of what side you're on. And so who do you think's running the show?
Steve, why don't you take that one?
Well, I think it should be the president. That's who should be running it when it comes to national security programs like this. Do I have a lot of confidence that there's firm leadership? No. But that's why a lot of us who care about these things have been out trying to explain things publicly and speaking out, trying to keep folks firm on issues where I think, frankly, the American people would be well served by some strong out front presidential leadership and public statements. So that's my two cents.
If I could add something that I think is in the spirit of this question, information is power, data is power. And there's a good reason why we Second Amendment advocates are very much opposed to gun registration. Which is, after all, nothing more than collecting information about who has guns and where they are. It doesn't restrict anybody's use of any gun, at least not directly. But the existence of that data, which of course actually could also be obtained through the metadata that the NSA is collecting, The existence of that data as to where all the where the guns are makes possible the abuse of our constitutional rights in the future. We prevent those abuses from happening in the future by denying government the information today when government is not in the in the position to actually violate the rights directly. And that's part of the problem that's raised by the collection of all this metadata, and I certainly don't limit it to the NSA. In my Wall Street Journal piece, I specifically included Dodd-Frank and the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau in my criticism. It's not limited to the NSA program, but the existence of all this metadata in the hands of government on supercomputers for an indefinite period of time could easily allow for abuses in the future, either illegal abuses or quite legal abuses, if the law should change in the future and politics should be different in the future. The way to prevent this from happening is the same way we prevent our gun rights from being restricted, and that is by preventing the existence of this information falling into the hands of the government itself. Having them in the hands of third parties, having them in the hands of companies that could contest subpoenas if possible, and who have an interest in who operate according to terms of services with their customers, that's less dangerous. That adds an additional check to the process than it would if the government has access to all the data that is of everything that we do, which is essentially what all these programs added together make possible.
So let me just say, first, you are fighting upstream. Data gets easier to collect, to easier to analyze, cheaper every year. The idea that we're going to keep data out of the hands of the government in the event, you know, when the dark night of fascism finally comes, I think is absurd. If the data is out there, and it is, it's going to get collected by the fascists we keep imagining under the bed.
So you don't have any problem with gun registration then? You don't have a practical, pragmatic problem with gun registration?
I would say as a practical, pragmatic. Okay. I would say as a practical, pragmatic point, if you ever bought ammunition online, your name is going to come up if some evil president someday decides to come for your gun.
And
the idea that keeping it out of the hands of the government today is going to change that strikes me as implausible, but that's not the fight we're having. Instead, you are attacking a vital anti-terrorism program in order to score points in a gun control debate, and I just think that is irresponsible.
Well, I have to respond to that. I'm not trying to score points in the gun control debate. I'm simply pointing out to the callers that there's a comparable problem that we all recognize in the gun control context, and that is the existence of a database that would allow the government to identify the location of all guns in the country would make easier the violation of our constitutional rights.
I understand.
And liberties
you want a
in the
less
future.
Efficient government. You want a less efficient government in the context of gun control. Fine, you can want that, and I may be skeptical about that, but the idea that you want a less efficient government and trying to protect us from people who want to kill us is crazy.
Well, Stuart, it sounds like you're going to get the last word. You're going to insist on having the last word.
No, you can have.
Yeah, I think Randy Barnett's really using an analogy there. He's not using this as an excuse to argue gun rights. And I think you do get to a point where a lot of folks have the same concerns that, given the unprecedented nature of the data collection program, and given the vastness of the information collected, the vast amounts of information collected, isn't there an opportunity for abuse by somebody who's in the system, inside the system, and who maybe has access to too much information or can get access to too much information, to use it for purposes that aren't really related to national security? That is, to verify that a certain individual was in touch on a certain date with a certain person for political reasons, for example.
Sure, there's always a risk of that, but that's why all the safeguards that are in place here, the fact that three branches of government, both parties, 12 judges have all signed off on this and oversee it, is important, and the requirement that you justify each year's searches. That's the best we can do if we want to be able to use this data to fight terrorism, in my view.
Well, let me turn this around and ask Randy Barnett then a question. Is there something – you mentioned maybe keeping the metadata in the hands of the private companies. Is there something more that could be done to the program, to the project as you understand it, that would allay some of your concerns, Professor Barnett?
Well, I mean, we're just getting started. We've only really found out about some of the details of the program in the last few weeks. It's going to take a while to figure out exactly what the scope of these programs are.
There's no additional check you could point to at this point that would.
Right now, the structural check that we currently have, what we don't currently have, but what we used to have, is the idea that we had a technological barrier to the ability to use information gained from pen registers and trap and trace and business records. There was a technological barrier to being able for the government to be able to actually get a hold of all of this data, which was in private hands, and then analyze it using computer models that allowed it to discern all kinds of things about us. This capability simply did not exist before. The absence of that technology was our ultimate structural protection. The physical inability to do all of this was our ultimate protection. Now that, as Stuart points out, more things are possible, we're going to have to think about other ways in which we can guard against it, including the keeping of the possession of this data out of the hands of government agents, out of the hands of the IRS, out of the hands of the FBI and the other government agencies that could have a hand in getting a hold of metadata.
Well, we've got about 5 minutes left. Let's take another call.
This is an anonymous caller from an anonymous location. Because as much
I
as
recognize
I would like
your voice.
Because as much as I would like to agree with Messrs. Baker and Bradbury, I'm afraid I have to agree to propositions advanced by Mr. Barnett. And I would simply remind the people on the call of words of Federalist 51, if men were angels, no government would be necessary. I think we lose our freedoms one at a time, and to use the argument that, well, we adopted an income tax 100 years ago, and now the IRS asks for all this intrusive data, and that's not a search, and that doesn't violate the Fifth Amendment, and now it's okay to do this, and next thing you know, it's going to be okay to do that. The problem is that somebody has to watch the watchman, and government has grown in a way that makes that no longer practical or possible.
Steve or Stuart, you want to respond to that? I think that
Ultimately,
do we have to trust the government here?
There's no doubt that we need as many checks as we can get. There are as many checks as I think anybody could imagine on this program, other than telling Al-Qaeda exactly how it works so that they could avoid it. I used to say when I was at NSA that there were a dozen people whose careers would be made if they could find an abuse that NSA was part of. And I think that's probably a number that has grown exponentially. There are cynical reasons for people to be pretty tough on abuses here. So if we're going to have any controls, I think these are probably as good as we're likely to get. And the alternative is to say, okay, so we'll just let Al-Qaeda take advantage of the inefficiencies of government. We'll keep this out of the government's hands. Al-Qaeda will know that if you spread your phone calls over different carriers, over different periods of time, nobody's going to actually be able to put those dots together. I don't think we should be in the position of making that argument.
Let me, Dean, if I could just for 30 seconds.
Quickly, and then we'll try and squeeze in one final question.
I think if the database were put in private hands, either under the control of the companies, most likely it would still have to be a single database to be at all useful in this way. You'd have to get a third-party vendor, like a government contractor or something to keep to maintain it. I think it would be distinctly less secure. There'd be greater potential for abuse and access in ways that are not anticipated or permitted under the current court order, and it'll be harder to do oversight and supervision of the use of the database. So I don't think that actually would be a better and safer outcome in terms of civil liberties.
All right, let's try and get a final question.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. Randy and I are noted for actually drafting amendments to try to deal with some of the abuses of our government, and I've been trying to draft one for this subject because I don't find the Fourth Amendment to really cover the subject. And what it seems to come down to is that we really need, perhaps constitutionally, to put limits on how many or what proportion of the population government is able to keep data on. Because at the moment, all this talk about them only saving metadata is nonsense. It's well known, has been for years, that they're collecting the contents as well. And there's no effective way to keep them from doing that. Not all the statutes, not all the regulations, because they're just going to ignore them. And you won't find out they're doing it because there won't be any way that you can find out that they're doing it, other than having a leaker. So
what's your question here then?
Question is, let's suggest we find ways of drafting either amendments or statutes or whatever, the actual language that would address the problem and not just talk about the problem, which is at this moment overwhelming.
Let me
respond to John's point, and I thank John for that. I think that one of the things that I would draw from John's point is that we can't look just to current doctrine to answer the question of whether this is necessary and proper, both necessary and proper. We can't look to even necessarily the Constitution itself to do that. That's one of the reasons why I think Congress needs to get into it, and they are getting into it. But the possibility of constitutional amendments are another thing. All of this discussion is made possible by leaked information that then led to declassified information. I think that, you know, maybe Steve agrees that this is a constructive talk as long as we don't give away methods of and techniques that would be of use to our enemies. This is a useful talk to have. But the very existence of these secret programs in secret, the way they have been operated up until recently, has prevented this kind of discussion from taking place. And now I think it's a healthy thing that the discussion does take place so that we can figure out exactly how to handle it in ways that, given the fact that we are, in fact, facing a new world with new technologies and new powers and abilities that go far beyond that which mortal men previously had.
I will just add as a personal matter that I was out at the agency for years, and the one thing, John, that I completely disagree with you about is the idea that the agency will gather this information no matter what the law says. I've never seen an agency that is more concerned about observing the law, because they know how significant their powers are and how controversial they can be, than NSA. I would be absolutely astonished to discover what you have assumed, which is that they will violate the law. I just don't believe it.
Final thought, Steve Bradbury?
My only thought is I like the Constitution we have, and I think it can accommodate these debates. I do think they're healthy. I don't think we need any amendment of the Constitution on these issues. Thanks.
Well, there's a great deal left on the table here, more to discuss, but I'm afraid we're out of time. Let me thank, on behalf of the Federalist Society, Steve Bradbury, Stuart Baker, Professor Randy Barnett, for joining us today. This has been a fascinating discussion and I think very helpful. Maybe we can reconvene at some point in the future. To our audience, of course, thank you for joining us and thank you for your questions. Our next Teleforum conference call is this Thursday at 12 noon. We'll be discussing some recent developments in the public use doctrine. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.